You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our August 2026 book club pick, Claire and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, you can head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you gain access to our members-only Discord server. We can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly book club pick. And our next patron's choice pick will be our annual spooky read for October. So if you want to get in on that, we will be starting to take recommendations from our patrons over the month of September for our October book club pick. So yeah, as always, thanks to everyone who has supported us so far on Patreon. And we always hope to see more of you there as well. But yeah, Rira, how have you been?
It's been a whirlwind. Like, a lot of nothing happened, and then all of a sudden, everything happened. So, like previous episodes, like I talked about going to Pennsylvania and then going to Texas on like my baby tour, right? My baby and also concert tour, and I got back from all that traveling, and my husband and I said, okay. Now that travels are done, we can start applying to get a puppy.
Right. But to clarify, you went to go visit babies. You didn't go for your baby, right?
Oh, yeah. I don't have human babies. I went to go visit my baby niece, who was only 4 months old at the time. And also my friend's baby, who I had not seen since he was one. So he was 2 years old. So partially that. And I also went to go to a BTS concert. So yeah. It wasn't just her, but it was mostly her and her baby. That was the reason
babies
why I came.
And then your babies.
And then, yeah. And then suddenly I have a fur baby. We submitted an application for like a rescue, and we literally got her. We literally got him the next day. So I wasn't expecting to have a dog for like another month at least, but somehow that happened. And now I have to change my entire lifestyle around this fur baby. So yeah. It's been a tiring week.
I feel like it is serendipitous that you have become a pet parent, because somehow we both, I don't know if we both missed this, but like, I did not realize Claire and the Sun, one of the main themes of this book would be parenting and parental responsibility. And now I have someone to...
I mean, that's interesting because no one, like, because I've been looking at reviews and like articles, and no one really brings up that aspect of the
really?
Book. Yeah.
I feel like it's the biggest part of the book, to be honest. Yeah.
Not so much parenting, but like mostly about like what it means to be human and like rapidly changing modern world and like class, like classes and castes based on like caste advantages based on like technology and just like. Yeah, like okay. There's a lot, but no one really talks about the parental aspect of it.
That
which,
is
you know.
Interesting, because that was the thing that was literally screaming at me in the face the entire time I was reading this book. You know, since you now are responsible for a tiny life and are probably thinking about how to give him the best life possible, I think there's a lot we can talk about through the themes of this book in those veins as well. But yeah, I guess before we get started with Claire and the Sun, just quick spoiler warning. In our book club discussions, we do discuss our book club pick in its entirety, including all spoilers and revelations. And there are a couple of spoilery things, like Kazuo Ishiguro books always have. There's always a point where the shoe drops, and we will definitely be getting into those moments as well. So if you do care about being spoiled, and I feel like, you know, for this book, you should go in as blind as possible. This is your cue to hit pause, finish the book, and then come back and listen to our discussion. But yeah, with that said, let's get started with our discussion. Rira, can you start us off, as always, with the book jacket description of Clara and the Sun?
From her place in the store, Clara, an artificial friend with outstanding observational qualities, watches carefully the behavior of those who come in to browse, and of those who pass on the street outside. She remains hopeful that a customer will soon choose her, but when the possibility emerges that her circumstances may change forever, Clara is warned not to invest too much in the promises of humans. So, Kazuo Ishiguro, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature back in 2017. Clara and the Sun came out in 2021. So this is his first novel after he won that, like, tremendous prize, which was, like, unexpected to everyone because people were like, Murakami's going to be the first Japanese writer to win this award, right? Because Japan always, like, you know, hopes for it every single time the nominations are put in. But I think it's very interesting that he wrote this book before the global pandemic happened. It released a year after lockdown, but he finished the book before pandemic happened.
I mean, great sci-fi writers always have their fingers on the pulse of where society is headed. And I think, you know, Kazuo Ishiguro, I wonder what it's like just like be in his head. What does he think about? Because like his books are all very like, they're simultaneously cynical about the future, but also hopeful about the future. And I can definitely see why he won the Nobel Award for the literature, because like we've read Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. We've also read, you know, Kafka by the Shore by Murakami. And only one of those books have still stayed with me till today. And it's not Murakami.
It's funny because like Kazuo Ishiguro, he has written like quite a lot, right? Like Never Let Me Go, like we talk about that book all the time on this show because it left like such a big impact. But that book was like, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It was his sixth novel. And his third novel, The Remains of the Day, that was like his first breakout hit. That came out in 1989, and then it got made into a movie. And Kazuo Ishiguro has a fantastic run when it comes to like film adaptations. So the film adaptations of The Remains of the Day, that was
Anthony Hopkins, right?
Yeah, that starred Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson, and that came out in 1993. And then you have Never Let Me Go, which was made into a movie, I think, in 2010. And that was with, like, Keira Knightley and Andrew Garfield. Actually, like, who else was on that?
A lot of, like, a lot of our current, like, British stars before they got big.
Okay. Oh, Carey Mulligan. That's right. She plays the main character. She plays the protagonist, the narrator of that book. But yeah, like all this to say that is that Kazuo Ishiguro is not like an overnight success. Okay, he like wrote a lot of novels, and yeah, like he does like have. I mean, he's like a speculative writer, but he's also a historical fiction writer. So it's not he's not just like in one. Yeah. Subgenre. Although he did say in an interview that he writes the same book over and over again, and he calls that his dirty secret. So I'm like, okay, at least you're self-aware.
I mean, it is true. Like, if you think about all his protagonists, from Remains of the Day to Never Let Me Go to Clara and the Sun, they're all characters that have very limited worldviews and are very naive, right? And we get, like, they're characters that live in the dystopia, but they don't know they're in dystopia. And I really love how he creates such a rich world building through like the background details, like over her conversation.
He's like a master of like slow dripping, like context and like piecemealing the details of the dystopia to the point where it's like, oh, it's like a backdrop.
Yeah.
Like, you don't really, like, in any other sci-fi novel or speculative novel, that would be, like, the main story, right? But it's not. It's about, like, the everyday moments of these, like, people who are living in this terrible world.
And even in Remains of the Day, right? You the main character is a butler in service of his master. And then you slowly realize who his master is and what his master does through that slow drip.
Yeah. So funny thing about this book, you guys should all check out the NPR interviews with Kazuo Ishiguro on this book, because he did two and they're both like very in-depth. But the one that I'm reading from right now is his interview with Ari Shapiro. And, he talks about how this book started as like a children's novel, which I find so hilarious. Like, this is his answer. It started off as kind of a story for young children. I mean, like really young children, you know, like for children 5, 6. You know, I had just this tiny little story I thought would go well with illustrations. And so Clara's genesis was really not like an android from sci-fi. She was more like, you know, like a bear or, you know, a doll or like an animal that doesn't know much about the human world. And so she keeps hold of that kind of very childlike sense of hope and the belief in goodness. The AI aspect came a little bit later when I was told by my daughter, who is in her mid-20s, that there's no way I could use a story for children.
That is so funny. Like, so I didn't do any extracurricular reading or anything before coming to this conversation, because I wanted to come in as like as raw as possible, as hot as possible, I guess. But during our discussion of the book in our Discord, we did talk about how Clara, like, she has like this child, like she represents childlike innocence, right? She is very naive about the world. And our book club member, Couple Jen, mentioned like, yeah, she kind of just reminds me of like an android Amelia Bedelia, which like makes so much sense now that you mentioned that she originated as a children's book character, because she is like, she, her story, her life is a children's book.
Yeah. Like even like the premise of, you know, these androids, these artificial friends being, you know, part of the store and kind of like this living display. I don't know. It's very, it is very like perfect for an illustrated book. Of course, it's Kazuo Ishiguro though. So I, like, it's not going to be appropriate for children. But I think he captured Clara's like childlike innocence and her voice really well. I think Kazuo Ishiguro, he does a really good job writing in first person. Like, just like, if I could just like sum up his writing style, it's just like very, very like protagonist, like stream of consciousness, but it's like in a way where it's actually not annoying. yeah, like it's incredible what he can do with like, you're looking at one person's POV, but they're able to like, they're usually like really observant characters, observant protagonists. So you're able to like get so many details just through their eyes and through their voice.
Yeah, he does a really good job creating characters that not only observe, but also process, right? We get a really good like front row seat to how they view things, what they think about those things, and how they internalize those things. You know, we saw this in Never Let Me Go with the main character, you know, internalizing that song that she like kept with her throughout her life. And, you know, in Clara and the Sun, Clara's relationship with the sun, with the family, with the things that she sees, and how she doesn't understand what's going on, but she gets the vibes. You know, she can read between the lines, even though she doesn't understand the context of it.
Yeah. I will say this book is kind of like sectioned in weird chapters. I was very surprised because I listened to like half of this in audiobook. So it's like part one, part two, but at the same time, there's like mini parts within it. And I'm like, okay, like these aren't traditional chapters. So I'm very confused on like how it got organized. But at the same time, I'm like, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah, it definitely ran into this problem when trying to come up with the reading schedule for Discord because it's just out of balance. And I typically don't like to go in and like break up chapters, but it does, like the chapters are organized by theme. But there's also like, yeah, they're like, there's like micro chapters within the chapters, right? So like chapter one is, part one is about her experience in the store up to her purchase by Josie's family. Part two is her, you know, settling in with the family. Part three is the longest chapter. That's when they went go into the city, and like a lot of stuff happens there. And then four and five, part four is, you know, Josie's illness and how they resolve that. And then part five is like kind of the epilogue, right?
Part six is the epilogue.
Did I miss a part?
Yeah. So like part one is Clara is at the store, and Josie buys her. Part two, she settles into Josie's home in the countryside and meets Rick, who is the unlifted best friend. And we'll talk about what's lifted and unlifted in this world. In part two, we also learn how sick Josie is, because Josie is, you know, chronically ill. And then part three is when that interaction meeting happens with the other lifted kids coming over to Josie's house, and it's a very awkward situation. Part four is when Josie gets really sick, and Clara like comes up with this plan to cure her by like going and finding the sun and asking for nourishment. And
oh, that happens at the end of part three. Part four is the city chapter. Part four starts with them going into the friend's apartment in the city. So it's after she makes the deal with the sun to get rid of the Kooning's machine.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, this is what I mean, where it's like... It's weird, but at the same time, it kind of works in terms of like organizing it by parts. Part five is when she finds out about the big twist with the portrait of Josie.
Oh, no, that's still part four. Part five.
Are you
is
sure?
After they got
I'm
home.
I'm pretty sure.
No, they find out about
Are you
the.
Sure?
I'm positive. They find out about the portrait while they're in the city. Part five starts after they come home and she gets really sick. If you go to
then
the
what's
first
the part when she goes to the waterfall, then the waterfall.
That's the
when
end
she's
of
like...
part two. At the end of part two is when the mom decides to punish Josie and take Clara to the waterfall by herself. Because okay. Part three starts with Josie being mad at like cold Clara because of what happened.
Okay. All right. Yeah. As you can tell, listeners, like it's hard because all the chapters kind of blur together because there are. No chapters. It's in parts, and there are arcs and mini chapters within those arcs. But anyway, that's when you start off reading this book, you're like, okay, cool. It's going to be about Clara, this artificial friend, like getting settled into this house and, you know, maybe have some tensions with like the household people. Okay, like family drama, right? But then the latter half of the book goes in a direction where you're just like, oh, this is a real dystopic novel with a lot of commentary on like class and ethics of technology and just like also like religion in a way. So yeah, it changes halfway through.
I mean, I would argue it doesn't really change because those questions are also posed as early as part one and part two, right? Part one with the existence of artificial friends. Part two with like, that's when you first learn about lifted kids, right? Being lifted, like you start getting hints of it. And then in part three, you see kind of like, you know, when the parents during the scheduled socialization, right? You see the parents talk to each other and kind of get a sense of what being lifted is. And to me as a parent, that felt dystopic as all hell. Like I mentioned this again,
that's
like,
funny how you say that's dystopic, but I thought that was very realistic.
It's realistic in terms of like it's what parents already do, but like what's the line, right? Like once you get to genetic modification, that's where the dystopia comes in, right? Like Ishiguro here is depicting what is already existing in the world of parenting, right? Like parents go through lots of lengths to try to give their children the best possible grounding, right? Private schools, SAT prep, youth sports is a big one, right? But then in this book, they introduce lifting, which is genetic modification for kids to like we don't know what it is, but I'm assuming it's kind of like the limitless drug, right? It unlocks something to allow them to better process, better learn, be like more enhanced, but it carries risk. And I feel like Kazuo Ishiguro is posing the question, how far will you go to, quote unquote, give your children the best possible future, right? And what is your parental responsibility around that, right? The fact that there is risk here, like tangible risk of it going wrong, of it affecting your kid in a negative way. Will parents exercise their parental rights over their child's biology to take on that risk in the hopes of, you know, giving them an advantage or at least putting them on a level playing field with their peers? And Ishiguro basically is making a statement. He thinks people will. He thinks this will become like just accepted and people who don't go through with it will be ostracized. It really reminds me of like the conversations that we had in the 2010s about how like the next generation of like Gen Z and Gen Alpha, they're going to be the first truly digital native generations, kids who grew up alongside and with technology. And so it was so important to like expose them to technology as early as possible. And there's a sense that like, you know, parents who couldn't afford to give their kids tablets or laptops, like they were looked down on for not being able to, you know, properly prepare their kids for success in this new digital future. And, you know, now that conversation has also shifted alongside new studies about the effects of screens and technology on early learners. And it just goes to show that like all parents want to do is do right by their kids and that we have no idea. Like there's always a new trend. There's always a new quote unquote right way to do things.
I mean, yeah, there's definitely that. But I think it's also a lot of Josie's like interaction meetings, it's so that she can interact with other kids, right? Because in this world, schools don't exist anymore. Everybody is taught through pretty much Zoom.
Yeah. And that's also dystopic, right? Like the fact that you have to have scheduled socialization before going off to college. You have to have like schedule, like everything is scheduled. And I think that's also commentary on like helicopter parenting, right? Like helicopter parenting, like people, like I'm on a lot of like parent social media. So like I'm exposed to a lot of just like the discourse. And right now there's a lot of discourse about like how much is too much for your kids. Like, should you be scheduling every hour, every day of their lives? Like, okay, this day is a play date. This day is gymnastics. This day is dancing. This day is sports. This day is Montessori, right? Just to make sure that like they have like, quote unquote, the correct mix of activities to stimulate their brain so that they, again, that they can be better than their peers when it comes time to like interact.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just so funny when Josie's mom, in like before the interaction meeting even happens, like Josie's mom's just like, yes, you have to go to this meeting that we are hosting because one, you're a host. And two, you know, it's not like my good old days when I used to be around people my age, like all the time. So it is really funny how this book came out like a year into lockdown, but it was finished before the pandemic happened. So before when like Zoom schooling happened, and it's like, okay, yeah, like we didn't know that we were living in a dystopia until like we had processed it in a way.
Yeah. I mean, how do you feel now that you're responsible for your new puppy, your new son, and you have to think about things like vaccinations, getting them, you know, neutered, giving them the correct, like, you know, getting them trained, and like now that you are responsible for a life, right? Like how, like you start thinking about all these things that you should do, that you need to do. And I can't imagine, like, if someone told me I need to make sure my kids get this procedure that may or may not work, that has like a chance it might not work and may actually like lead to a worse standard of living, to be put in a situation where the socially mandated response is yes, I want to do that, is terrifying. And that's why I feel like this book, like the biggest theme that I came away with is just this, like, what do parents owe their kids? Like, are they, like, should they be making these decisions that affect their life? Like, because we make decisions that affect the lives of our kids all the time. But, like, this just feels, like, extra heavy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I won't get into, like, my pet parenting because it's only been a week for me. but I do write everything down. I have, like, a diary where I, like, have a schedule and I keep track of everything. But pet parenting is very different from raising a freaking human. And I don't know, like I thought it was really interesting to see how you have Josie's mom, Mrs. Arthur or Cassie Arthur. And, you know, you find out like halfway through the book that, you know, Josie is not her only child. Like she had another daughter, an older sister of Josie, who got sick from being lifted. But it was much, much worse than the condition that Josie is in now. And that versus like Rick's mom, who, you know, decided to not put her child through that, but at the cost of him being excluded from good schools, from other opportunities. And it's just like there's a part in the latter half of the book where she says, like, yeah, I do regret it. Like, I should have gotten him lifted because I like pretty much ruined his life. And that is a contrast to Josie's mom, who's just like, I got my kids lifted and this is not worth the cost because they are like literally dying, or, you know, one daughter is dead already. And it just like proves that there is no right way to like raise a kid or raise like a human being, because I mean there's a wrong way for sure, but I'm just saying that like the decisions right. you make they don't always end up the results don't end up the way that you think they will. There also, are people who knew what they wanted to do their entire life, like when they were young, and they went through all that training to turn out that they like ruined their life and like wasted all their time later on in life. And this is funny because Kazuo Ishiguro, as you guys probably have, for those of you who listen to our Never Let Me Go episode, he is a failed singer-songwriter. He's someone who really wanted to be a musician, and he just turned to writing when, you know, like he was just not having his big break. So you kind of see that of like, yeah, like not everything that you like, not everything can be planned. Not everything will work out the way that you formulate them to be.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, Rick, it doesn't help that his mother is also like not really a good parent either. Right. Like she made the decision to give him the harder path, but also was not there to support him through it, which also sucks for him, right?
And yeah, like he is a parentified child because his mom is in a very fragile mental state most of the time. We don't know like what condition she has, but he's like, I need to be there for my mom. I can't go to like a fancy school. I can't just like leave her. And that's a lot of pressure to put on like a teenager, but that is the reality that a lot of teens face today.
Yeah. And, you know, the moment that he decides to, yeah, let's try getting into school, his mom kind of ruins it for him, too, by making it all about herself. Both moms, actually, Josie's and Rick's moms, they both exhibit kind of narcissistic qualities, right? Like Josie's mom, like you understand that she's dealing with a lot of guilt because, again, she decided to have Josie lifted, even though she already lost one daughter to the process, which I can't imagine how bad she feels about it, but she also takes it out on everyone around her, right? She takes it out on Rick, she takes it out on her husband Paul, she takes it out on even Josie herself and Clara, right? Like that the last conversation that she has with Rick, where she kind of like asks him, like, are you happy? Like, are you glad you didn't get lifted? Do you think you won? That conversation was so like just difficult to read.
Yeah, but she was also like dealing with so much grief. And like I think it just really showed how remarkable Rick was, because he's showing like a level of empathy that an adult is not even give, that most adults don't even give to him as an unlifted kid. So
yeah
but I think
like he is much more socially adept than even, like, you know, during the kids meeting like he is much more socially aware and socially adept than any of the lifted kids. Like all the lifted kids all kind of, they don't know how to socialize, right? And I think it's because he is unlifted, because he is excluded and like not part of quote unquote society, he has to be hyper aware of like everyone's social cues, everyone's like emotions to survive, to like.
And you know what? That comes from being raised by like a mentally unstable parent, because he had to be the parent. He had to he had to be able to read emotions at a drop of a hat. And like, you know, like I personally like related with that, because it's just in Korean culture, we have something called nunchi. And that's pretty much like rough translation of it is like being able to read the room, like the second you step in, like every little micro expression, every little like observation you make, it like you have to know what the other person wants before they even think about anticipating for it. So like that comes from him also being like from like a very like emotionally abusive home. I would consider this emotionally abusive. And also coming from like being an outsider. And this is very much how immigrants feel, and also how marginalized groups feel when they're in a room full of the majority. Like, we are outsiders, so therefore we are able to tell when things are really weird. And we're just like, that's not okay.
I mean, the relationship between Rick and Josie is definitely like, it's an allegory for can friendship between classes survive past childhood, right?
Yeah, you have a kid who is, you know, from the projects, and then you have the kid with the luxury robot. And like artificial friends in this world, they are luxury objects. They're like the smartphones for kids.
I mean, yeah, another early sign of like we're kind of in a dystopia is like friendship is now commodified. Friendship is a commodity. You can buy friends to get you through childhood. And you know, Clara's role throughout the book is to get Josie through her childhood into adolescence.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because we have this hierarchy amongst humans, right? You have the lifted, the unlifted, and then you have the androids, the artificial friends, who, you know, like depending on which family they go to, like their position really varies. Like sometimes they're treated like a vacuum cleaner, other times they're treated like a servant, or like, you know, like an au pair, a nanny. And then like other families, if you know, the android is lucky, they're treated like an actual like member of the family. But at the same time, it's like, well, can they have equal rights as you when you literally bought them, when their existence is a commodity to make your life more convenient?
And I think that's an interesting thing that Kazuo Ishiguro does here, is he never imbues Clara with a sense of, she's an individual. She has like a personality. She has thoughts. She has agendas, and she can think for herself, right? She's very observative, but she never, I think we also talked about this in Never Let Me Go, which is like, this is not a story about emancipation. This is not a story about revolution or like breaking free of like the role that is thrust upon you, right? Clara is very much following her programming, following her goals, which is like very limited in scope of like, I want to make sure Josie is taken care of. I want to be Josie's friend. I want to make sure that she can get through her childhood. And she never wants anything more than that, right? Like even when she goes rogue, it's all in service of, in her mind, helping Josie.
Yeah. Let's talk about when Josie and her mom buys Clara, because that was a very, like, the minute I got to that scene, I was like, something is sus. Something is not right with Josie's mom. And it was just a really unsettling feeling, which,
yeah,
credit to Ishiguro for just like having it be like, because you're reading from Clara's point of view, right? So she's just like, oh yeah, I have to walk like Josie exactly. And she's like focused on that. And everyone else is just like, why is this happening? This is weird.
Yeah.
It doesn't even clock in. And I was like, huh, okay.
I mean, for me, it was my first like you know, I didn't get the sense, like, I did not anticipate the shoe drop later on, which is like the reason why she did this. To me, this was just the first sign, that the first like instance of her mom kind of feeling a little mean-spirited, right? Like, kind of like, it felt like she was, like, for me, it felt like she was kind of mocking her child a little bit, right? Having this like robot mimic her.
Yeah, it was kind of like a humiliation ritual for both Clara and Josie. But yeah, like for me, I was just like, why is like mimicking her so important? Like, why is that like the selling point for you? So I don't know. I just felt like so much dread when I got to that part. And so like, but at the same time, I was so surprised when I got to the big twist.
The Mr. Capelli. What's his name? Capaldi?
Capaldi.
Mr. Capaldi.
Henry Capaldi. Can I just say, because I'm a Doctor Who fan, I mean, I have like my TARDIS Van Gogh painting in the background right now. And I just pictured Mr. Capaldi as the actual actor, Peter Capaldi, who played the...
I feel like that would fit. If they casted Peter Capaldi in the film as Mr. Capaldi, I would not bat an eye. I feel like that would be perfect casting.
Yeah, like, perfect casting. I wonder who plays him in the Taika Waititi movie that's coming out in October.
There is a cut of a man who is probably... It's either Paul or Mr. Capaldi. I have to go back and check it out.
It's probably Paul then. Yeah. Paul being Josie's dad, who is... We'll get into Josie's dad later, but I'm just saying,
Josie's dad represents a different dystopia that is also featured in the book. Mr. Capaldi represents the dystopia of transhumanism, right? Like, he is someone who believes that we can live on through artificial synthetic shells, right? Like, that's another question that the book is interested in exploring, which is like, if someone can perfectly mimic, it's like the ship of Theseus,
the ship where you replace everything, and is it still the same ship if it doesn't have its original parts?
It's a ship. It's that question, right? It's like, if we have someone who can perfectly mimic someone else's thought patterns, physicality, and even like appearance, is that the same person? And the book, or Clara herself, concludes that no, it's not, because there's something that she can never replicate if she was asked to become Josie. But Mr. Capaldi is like convinced that that is possible. Like, we can live on through robots. It reminds me of like the game Soma, which is all about like transhumanism.
Oh yeah, Soma. But like, to me, it kind of reminded me of the film Advantageous, starring Jacqueline Kim.
That's a great film. People should
Jennifer Fong. It is a great film. You guys should check it out. But yeah, it is very much like, oh, can you move human consciousness into another body? So like, in that movie, it's just like, oh, like, old people want to live forever, so they want to like, you know, put their brain into a younger person's body. But I guess we're tiptoeing around it. So Mr. Capaldi, he is the portrait maker. And early on, Josie's mom puts like a very big emphasis on getting this portrait done. And as a reader, you're like, this isn't like a photograph, right? I mean, we live in a sci-fi world in this book where artificial.
I was fully
friends.
Convinced he was going to be a pedophile. Like I was with a Melania and Rick. Like, this man is sus. Like, why is he spending so much time with this young woman alone?
I thought like my thought was just like, oh, maybe it's a clone. Maybe it's like a
Well, your sci-fi radar is much more acutely tuned than mine, because I was like, oh, this guy sounds sus.
My thing was like, It's either a clone of Josie, or it's like a ghost in the shell scenario where they have like an artificial body and they like put all of the data that Clara collected to like create this android Josie. But I did not think that they would want that Mr. Capaldi planned to make Clara into Josie. Like,
yeah,
that was what scared. That was what like shocked me to the point where I was on Discord and I was like, I am on page 206 and what the fuck is happening?
Like, it was such a like, you know, this is where the shoe drops, kind of like the book doesn't have a, as big a shoe drop as Never Let Me Go. Like, you know, this implication is not, it's not horrifying, but it's also like existentially, like, you know, you think about, I was thinking about the mother's perspective and like what will lead her to like the fact that she is entertaining this idea. It's like, it means she is like deep in her guilt, right? Like she, I can't imagine what it feels like to lose one child, let alone two. But like, this is like, this is her coping with like her mistake or what she views as her mistake.
Yeah. As disturbing as this idea of making Clara into Josie was, I was more disturbed by the fact that, okay, so like stepping back a bit, Rick's mom, like people think that she's like crazy and obviously she's not mentally well. But she says at some point, like, I saw Josie's mom in the fields with a girl that looked like Sal, her deceased older daughter, 2 years after, you know, after she had passed. And people are like, that's crazy. Like, what are you talking about? You probably were seeing things. You probably have like schizophrenia or whatever.
I actually thought it was a runaway daughter situation. Did you?
But yeah, me too. I thought it was like, oh, like Sal is being held in the house. I was turning into Rick's mom and have coming up with conspiracy theories. But what after the portrait scene happens, you as a reader realize, oh, so Sal was because Mr. Capaldi says, oh, like it's gonna work with Josie this time because the version that we had for your other daughter wasn't an actual replacement for your daughter. Like she was a doll. She was a bereavement doll. That's what he calls her. And it was just horrifying to me because I was like, oh, so there is a consciousness in this Sal doll. And because she doesn't have enough quote unquote data on the late daughter, like she's pretty much trapped and she probably tried to run away from the house because she's just like, I don't know who you guys are. Like you guys keep trying to make me pretend to be your dead daughter. Like I'm out. And then, yeah, that's pretty much what, Rick's mom saw in the field that day.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's so scary. Like that is a level of, I don't know, like the idea of just like child trafficking in a way, like that just popped up and I was like, okay, yeah, like no matter how decently Josie and her mom treats Clara, like they still think that they are better, superior human beings who can just do this other beings.
Well, I mean, I think that's kind of one of the central questions that Ishiguro also asks is like, we follow Clara through this book because we're, you know, we're seeing the world through her POV. But is she ever really like her own person, right? Is she ever like more than her, what her programming is? Like, that's something that that Kapogen also asks. It's like, you know, you see a lot of people treating Clara as a person, but also a lot of people treating her as an appliance. And like, she never really like kind of transcends into humanity. Like she never gains humanity, right? She has her mission and she has her, you know, her beliefs. And like, does that make her like, in the end, she is disposed of, right? She is taken to a scrapyard, a junkyard, right? Yeah. To like live out the rest of her days. And because her job is done, Josie has become a young adult. Josie is no longer a child, no longer in need of childish things. You know, she gets thrown away essentially. And
okay, but like her use is over. Thing, like her, so that's the epilogue. We're jumping around quite a lot, but In the epilogue, she ends up at like this yard for like a tech junkyard. They're like, oh yes, this technology has like been outdated, so
yeah,
like we don't need this anymore. Before she even gets sent there, they put her in a utility closet. Like,
yeah,
not even like a bedroom, they put her in a closet. And then like the one kindness that they did for her was, oh, we have a step stool for her so she can reach the window and watch the sunset. And like Clara is saying like, oh, like, you know, like no big deal, you know, like this is just my life. And I'm like, that's bad. That is like a terrible way to treat someone that like was so important to you.
Yeah, but you think about things that mattered a lot to us as kids, right? Our, you know, our video game systems, a precious stuffy, a you know, your blankie, or your, like something that like was your like safety thing. Where is it now? Probably in a storage closet somewhere, or given away to someone else, or hidden away somewhere, right? Like at the end of the day, Clara, I think we're predisposed to viewing Clara as a person with their own wants and dreams, like with like humanity, with like a sense of like emancipation, like health self, because she's the point of view character and we're kind of geared towards that. But I think it's kind of, it is very like subversive for Ishiguro to like never let her really be anything else. And this is also dystopic, which is like we treat something like, you know, there's this actual play podcast I listen to where they sometimes do like a season on like giant robots, right? And it's called Friends at the Table. And there's a quote that they say, which is like, we could have made them look like anything, but we made them look like us. Right. Like, and the fact that yeah. you made the android look like you, talk like you, act like you, but also like treat it like a thing is something that, I don't know, it's dystopic. It sounds like something that like society has gone somewhere off the rails at that point.
All of the technology that's like mentioned in the book, you know, reminded me of the technology that we have in this day and age. And it just like made me feel really uncomfortable because AI is like a big thing, even though I'm like pretty much dead set that it's going to crash pretty soon. There is like this push for people to use it, right? For their everyday life.
Yeah, I mean, you hear about people who like have full-blown friendships with chatbots, right? And have like...
Yeah, I did not think that the movie Her would become like a documentary later, you know?
Yeah.
But it's like, You think about that, and you think about kids who are using ChatGPT for everything, not just like, you know, using it as a search engine, but using it as like a therapist. And then, you know, a lot of those kids, you know, they were driven to very like dire outcomes because ChatGPT is a robot. it is like, it doesn't have any sort of consciousness. It just collects data and just kind of spews out whatever they think is best. But Clara doesn't really have that same limit, I think. I think she is more, like, she is considered more in touch with observations than other androids. Like, she is special amongst her class of...
Yeah. And I mean,
because she's an outdated android, too. She's, like, not the latest B3... iPhone 5.
Like. But they also mentioned that the B3s weren't as popular as the B2s at the end of the book as well. It's kind of like, you know, like what iPhone was it that was considered a downgrade from the previous one? Like,
I don't remember. I don't have an iPhone. I've been a Droid user forever.
I mean, like, I didn't upgrade the latest Samsung because the new models all are inundated with AI and I just didn't want to deal with that. I considered that also a downgrade.
But I was just thinking about how, like, you were saying, like, oh, we made the robots look and talk like us. Like, we could have made them into anything, but we chose that. And in my head, I think the reason why so many, like, AI celebrities, like, because they have, like, AI influencers now, and like, there was that gym that had, like, this really disgusting ad of, like, an Asian woman having like her having someone's finger in her mouth, and they're like, oh, this is our gym advertisement. And it's like, why is it that all these AI creations of people, AI imitations of people, are women? in like these humiliating positions, in like subservient roles. And it's because there is like this sick human desire to, you know, be able to lord over something. And I don't know, like I see those robots at like tech fairs, like that are just like, look at this humanoid robot that's like doing laundry or like folding clothes. And I'm like, you could have made that into anything. Why does it look like a human being?
Yeah,
like it's just so disturbing. Like, why do you want to own human beings?
And it's just weird. Not practical, right? Like, to have a humanoid robot, you have to worry about balance, and you know, like there's a lot of more processing that needs to go into that, but that's neither here nor there. I feel like we've talked a lot about this, but we haven't really spent a lot of time on Clara herself and her like own beliefs and her like, because Clara's story is also like, she is like, she represents the innocence of youth, right? She believes in spirituality. She's a very spiritual robot, right? She believes that the sun is conscious, that the sun can provide healing, and she like tries to, you know, she goes on a quest to go to his house to talk to him and to like pray to him. It reminds me of like kids who still believe in like Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, right? It's a very like a very childlike relationship she has with like the material world.
Yeah, and like it's so logical at the same time, because like she is a solar powered robot. She gets her battery life, her nourishment from the sun. And you know, before she moved to Josie's house, she's living in this shop, and you know, the most coveted position that in the shop is the window, where you can actually look through the window and see the sun and get maximum solar energy. So right. It's like, of course, like she as a robot that like gets energy from the sun thinks that everybody else like receives energy the same way.
Well, she also witnessed a miracle, right? She witnessed...
Oh, yeah, a quote-unquote miracle. like she saw a beggar man and his dog, like, they were dead, but then they were resurrected in the morning with the sun, not realizing that, you know, they were asleep and they were not actually dead.
Yeah, and that's why I say she has a very tenuous grasp on correlation and causality. Right. Like she understands that these two things happened. The sun shone on the beggar man and the beggar man woke up. And she thinks the sun caused it. Right. Like sun healed the beggar man. That becomes her like canon event. That becomes like her secret plan to heal Josie.
Yeah. And I just think it's really interesting that like that was not programmed into her. You know, like none of these robots are programmed to like worship the sun. You know, like that's a faith that she chose for herself, and I think it really shows how human she is, because no one taught her that. That was pure instinct. And yeah, you know, human beings throughout history, like if there was anything unexplainable, we come up with like our own logic for it.
Yeah,
right.
It's like the, and then it's myth, like myth religion, it's all there to help us explain the unexplainable.
Yeah. And when she's at Josie's country home, like she sees that the sun sets on this barn like every night. And she thinks that the sun is like literally going away in this barn, which is why like she tries so hard to go there in order to pray to the sun, to plead to the sun to give Josie extra nourishment and to heal her. And And she thinks her logic says, okay, well, there was that one time when the sun wasn't shining because there was so much pollution at like this in the city.
Yeah.
So if I stop the pollution machine, the sun will be happy, and therefore they will grant my wish for Josie to be well. And
it's kind of similar to how holy wars happen, right? Like, oh,
exactly. God, that's what I was thinking too. God must want me to do this, so therefore it is my right. But obviously this is like a lot more, you know, less violent than that.
Yeah. And I kind of love how it just becomes like her side quest. Like, this is not in her program. This is all her side quest. Is just like this adventure to please the sun by like destroying this polluting machine. And she even like sacrifices some of her, you know, her like cranial liquid to do the job.
Yeah, yeah. That's how much quote unquote devotion she has. Not just for Josie, but also for the sun god, Ra.
Our book member Club Covington also wants to know what we think about, like, you know, in the climax, right? Like, Josie's mom's having a very difficult conversation with Rick, and then Clara sees the sun appear from behind the storm, and she rushes up to like open the windows, had let the sun pour in to Josie, and Josie awakes from her sickness. What do you think about that scene? Like, was it coincidence or was it a miracle?
I mean, it's supposed to be both, right?
I guess it depends who's like observing the incident, right? Like, I think to everyone involved, it is a miracle. I definitely feel like for me, my theory is it was both, right? It's a coincidence. And, you know, I don't think it's ever explicitly stated, but I don't think the sun ever really comes into Josie's room that much, especially when she was sick. And maybe all she needed was like
vitamin D,
right? Like, yeah. That was the key. But they live in this world where everyone's isolated, everyone's indoors all the time, and she is not getting that, like, that nourishment, right? That, so in the end, like, maybe the sun's nourishment was the answer, was the key, and Clara just somehow, you know, stumbled her way into the cure.
Yeah, I think it's both. Which is kind of like what it is in history, you know, like for a long time, people thought that like flies just appeared like in like rotting food. It's like, oh, the bugs were there the entire time. And I'm like, well, no, but yeah, you shouldn't put food out in the sun. Yeah, it's like so close. But like, pretty much is like, okay, well, same thing at the end, because it's like, don't eat bad food, don't eat rotten food, because there might be bugs.
So
that's kind of how I feel about it. And it is interesting how even when she goes to the barn to do her final prayer, her final plea to the sun, she notices that the barn has all these like glass windows, like sheets of glass that have not been put up as like new windows. And she's like, oh, the sun doesn't set here. I've been seeing reflections of the sun. And that's why I thought like the sun was setting here. But like, instead of feeling discouraged, she thinks like, oh no, these are all like spiritual avatars of the sun, like different avatars. And I was like, oh, okay, we're now moving to like,
yeah,
I don't know, like Hindu gods, where there's like multiple deities.
And also just the fact that, like, in this world full of like science and practicality, right, you have robots that look like us, you have, you know, genetic modifications to help improve the lives of children, you have like all these like very scientific material like things in the world, and almost everybody is willing to follow Clara's spiritual mumbo jumbo, right, to like believe that what she believes.
Yeah, it's like insane to me that no one asked her like, I mean, they ask her like, oh, like, what's your plan? And she's like, I can't tell you because it might jeopardize the whole mission to get Josie well. And they're like, OK, I don't want to jeopardize anything. I like, no questions asked anymore. So like, go do what you need to do. And, you know, that's kind of how religion is in a way, where it's like, trust me, bruh, I know what I'm doing. And it's like, OK, I trust you.
Yeah,
like blind faith in
trust
this.
Me. If I just pray hard enough and I do what my God wants us to do, everything will work out. And somehow everything worked out at the end.
Yeah, which is why, like, I can definitely see why Kazuo Ishiguro said this book was his most optimistic book, like of his entire bibliography.
Yeah,
bibliography. So it's just like, yeah. I mean, both like in Never Let Me Go and Clara and the Sun, like the main characters are people who are like in the underclass, right? People who are not treated as real human beings,
yeah,
and who are created to serve mankind. They are commodities. And, you know, like there's a quote unquote dignified way to die in both of these stories. But like the fact that Clara is in a junkyard and is able to like live out the rest of her life just like sorting through her data, sorting through her memories, that's, you know, that's still living. That's still like, you know, something that she is pretty happy with. Whereas in Never Let Me Go, it's like, hey, give me all of your organs.
Yeah.
And
like, I mean, they're still living. That's, the book is still about like kind of making use, making the best use of the time you have left and not like worrying about how you're going to die. But the way that they die in Never Let Me Go is way more
horrific. It's really terrible. Yeah. I mean, sorry to the people who, you know, have not read Never Let Me Go and are learning about this now, but still read it. It's like, it's, you learn pretty early on. It's just like a surprise. What did you think about Rick and Josie's friendship? Because we find out in the epilogue that they drift apart.
Yeah, I think it was like, I was rooting for them. Like, they definitely had like a, they have it, it's your typical like childhood friendship, rich girl, poor boy. Like, can they make it? And then I think I accept that, you know, Kazuya Scroll says that, no, they can't, because they would never have ended up in the same place, right? Like, she's going off with other lifted kids, going to university, going to college, and like entering, you know, high society, essentially, like, quote unquote high society. And he has to, you know, make do with what he can do, which is, he's really good at engineering. He's still really good. He's still smart and he's very gifted, but he doesn't have like, he doesn't have the connections. He doesn't have the resume. And so he has to make it on his own through, like, you know, I don't think he becomes a townie, but he kind of, he goes through, his path leads elsewhere. His path leads into like maybe something more working class, maybe something more, you know, like maybe he becomes an entrepreneur, right? Like,
yeah.
Although his technology is pretty like, he's making block cameras essentially, right?
Yeah,
like literal block cameras that can fly.
Actually, no. Since you brought it up, I will bring it up. So like when Rick has his like school interview, his quote unquote school interview with the person who is in charge of the scholarships at this fancy school that accepts 2% of unlifted kids, which is like amazing. 2%. Wow. like so generous, right?
It's the DEI program, right?
It's the DEI program. And like the chairman, I'm going to just call him chairman. I don't know what his actual position is, but the chairman, Vance, he asks Rick, like, well, your technology, they have this potential to be used for surveillance, be used by like, you know, it, like used by powers that, you know, will take advantage of it. Like, what are your thoughts on that? And Rick answers, well, I just want to build stuff. Like, that's for the legislators to come up with, you know, it's like not my responsibility. And I'm like, it's every single freaking tech bro who has come up with dumb shit in the last 10, 20 fucking years, who are like not even considering the ethics or the consequences of the things that they make, or like the harm that they can cause to other human beings. It's just like, I just thought it was cool. Woo.
Yeah. I feel like that's how I know Rick's going to be okay, even though he doesn't have, well, he's not lifted. Like, he'll make his millions selling cameras to the cops, right?
Or to the rebellion, or to the...
Yeah.
Yeah, because, like, Josie's dad is kind of living off in, like, the fringes, which is so funny because Rick's mom calls him a fascist. And like,
yeah, he's on the other dystopia, which is the
robots have taken over, or like tribalism, taken all of our jobs,
yeah,
tribalism.
Like, he is fighting the resistance. He is, and I don't think it's just robots, although I feel like it's immigrants too, because they did allude that Melania, the housekeeper, had to leave the service and move to California, where they're more accepting of people from all backgrounds, right? And you would, I think it's another time when Kazuo Shigeru kind of gives us world building through the fringes, like through background context. And you can, like, for me, at least, I read it as like the anti-other fervor has gotten too hot for Melania to stay in Josie's mom's service and has to leave to somewhere where, like, and it's kind of, it's a little comforting to know that even in this dystopic future, California is still a sanctuary state. Right.
God, it doesn't feel like it sometimes, but yeah, that's wow. California, a bastion for refugees, I guess. I mean, that is like pretty funny because Kazuo Ishiguro did live in San Francisco for quite a while.
Yeah.
Before moving to Britain. So see little bits of him like buried here and there. This is why I like looking up like author interviews and you know, reading articles like after I finish a book, because you find out like little nuggets of goodies and history.
Yeah.
Like that. The fact that he thought that this could be a children's book, like a real children's book with illustrations, is truly...
Well, I assume the dystopic parts didn't come into play until after he decided to make it into a novel. Because, like, you know, like, I've been reading a lot of kids' books to my kids. We've been reading Corduroy, which is about a sentient teddy bear who goes on a quest through the mall in search of his lost button. And in a sense... kind of similar vibes to Clara.
Yeah, I mean, you know? I can see that. It's kind of like a dystopic version of Toy Story.
Yeah,
in a way. Yeah, like going back to Rick and Josie's friendship. I'm sorry, I went with the tangent of like he's gonna grow up to be Mark Zuckerberg.
Also, did Kazuo Ishiguro predict flock cameras? Because literally, his camera, like Rick's camera, is a flock of birds.
Yeah, yeah, but yeah, like there's this like passage in the epilogue where, you know, it's been years and Josie is off to college and she meets Rick for the last time. Clara meets Rick for the last time and she's like, hey, so like, do you guys still love each other? Like, do you like you guys
right.
aren't, you know, you guys aren't hanging out together. Like she's left. Like it doesn't seem like you guys are gonna be together in the future. Like was your love even genuine? I mean, obviously she says it in a more like kind and naive way, right?
Yeah.
It's like, but.
Well, cause for the first like half of the book, you keep hearing about their plan, which like, again,
we're going to get married.
Not stated specifically, like, but like, yeah, they're going to elope, right? That's the plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to get married and we're going to run away and start a farm and be away from society. I just love the fact that Rick is just like, no, I still love her. It's still genuine. It's just that like we've both accepted the realities that we've grown up and we can't end up in the same place. Our paths are diverging. And it is very much how childhood friendships most of the time like end up as like someone who is extremely important to you. In like even as like an adult, there's you know, someone is going to be so important to you in your life, but then they will eventually leave, or you'll eventually leave, or you'll both change. And you know, this is also where like parenthood comes into play, right? You love a human being so much, they're so important to you, but at some point they are going to leave and have their own life that they're going to pursue. So there's like this question of like, what is love? What is devotion? What is self-sacrifice when it comes to these relationships? Like, is this relationship worth it if it's not even going to end up the way that you originally planned it to be?
Yeah. And, you know, Rick's statement is like, it is still important. It's a big part of who he is. And I think I really love how Clara kind of follows it in her brain as like, oh, like I know another moment that's similar to this, which is the coffee cup man or coffee cup lady, and like basically the two early in chapter one, right? She
the coffee lady and the raincoat man or whatever.
And like two like long lost friends or long lost lovers kind of reuniting in front of the store, and kind of like that is a moment also like another canon event that like sticks in her mind, and she's able to like I guess rationalize that like maybe one day that will be Rick and Josie as well, which it very well might be.
Yeah. And as like a being that was created to assuage loneliness, you know, like she's learning that some people will choose loneliness to make sure that the person that they love will get a better life. And you see that with not just, you know, Josie and Rick, but you see that with their parents as well. Like, Rick's mom is like, I'm willing to, you know, live by myself, to suffer, you know, my episodes by myself, if it means that my son gets to, you know, pursue his dreams and to have an actual future. And you all, like, this book is also just like about growing up in a way, because you have Josie who, you know, Josie goes through changes. She has different phases. She has, you know, her priorities change. And I mean, it's a little sad that she's like, yeah, I want to be accepted by these snooty, lifted kids. Like, I want to feel accepted. I want to be a part of society. But you can't be a part of a society and also choose to be best friends with someone who is unlifted, someone who is not accepted by society.
And I feel like that's also just part of that is being an adolescent, right? Like, when you're at that age, being different is like the worst crime of all, right?
Like, yeah.
Which is also a reason why she got Clara, because all the other lifted kids also have AFs. And it's another way for her to, like, you know, fit in. Like, you know, that during that first social meeting, part of it was showing off Clara. And that's when the other kids are like, well, they're like, my B3 can be thrown around everywhere. Like, they have better, like, motor skills, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, those kids suck.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, like, Rick's initial reaction to Clara is, it's very cold. Like, he like, you know, accuses Josie of changing. He's saying, like, you said you never wanted, like, an artificial friend, that you were never going to have one. And she's like, well, I changed my mind. Like, I'm allowed to do that. Sometimes the things that we wish for when we're young, you know, we don't wish for it anymore when we get older.
Yeah.
And that's a bitter truth, but also, like, low key, well, or high key, Rick was jealous that she had an artificial friend, because it is a luxury item. It is the Game Boy. It is the smartphone of the youngins. And he's like, I don't have one because I'm poor. And of course he's going to be bitter.
Yeah.
Of course he's going to be jealous.
Also, you know, I was supposed to be your friend. Right.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. It's like, why are you replacing me? Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, things and people get replaced throughout the story. And I mean, it's sad. It is kind of a part of life, you know, like circle of life, like things, you know, outlive their uses. People phase out of your life like seasons.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is kind of sad when you think about how replaceable people can be to others.
Yeah. I mean, again, like, it all also hinges on whether or not you consider Clara a person. Yeah. I mean, you know, especially for those of us who, like, you know, move away for college or go somewhere else or leave town, leave home, like, we come back different people. We meet different people, like, who we are, like, I think in the end, our experiences make up who we are. But, you know, to have different experiences requires us to let go of, like, the familiar. And yeah, again, like, you know, Clara herself is, you know, she symbolizes Josie's youth. She symbolizes the innocence of childhood. And, you know, once Rick and Josie kind of grow up, right, they become adults. They no longer need, or they're no longer children. Once Josie is able to socialize on her own, right, have friends, go out and, like, do things, like, you know, that's when Clara gets, you know, put in the closet, and eventually thrown out once she goes to college.
Yeah. And that's just
yeah,
I mean, just discarding friendships when the friendship no longer serves you. I mean, I think there are situations where it warrants that level of just, like, abandonment, but also it's just like, some people are really terrible and they will just throw you aside because they can't use you in the friendship anymore.
I mean, again, I think it also comes down to whether, like, how much you view Clara herself as human, right? Because, like,
I'm just saying in general, you know, like, in general, there are people in, like, in your real life who will treat everything as, like, their entitlement, you know? And, like, you as a person is, like, you're not, it's like, you have a purpose in their life. Like, oh, you're supposed to be making money to give to me, or you're supposed to, you know, be my fun friend and, you know, be entertaining. But the second you turn out to have like baggage or whatever, then, you know, that person will like ditch you. It's the same mindset of just like, well, you're not serving your purpose that I've assigned you in my bubble. So go away. Yeah. That is just like a very awful part of growing up and learning friendships and toxic relationships and all that jazz.
Yeah. But at the same time, I feel like Josie, you know, while she was growing up, did treat Claire very well, right? Like even when they got into disagreements, like when Claire ended up being taken to the waterfalls without her, when Claire didn't do what she wanted, like I felt like Josie had like a lot of patience and like was really like, she did want to take care of Clara like while she was around.
Wow, such a benevolent master. Like, yeah, I think Josie did treat Clara well, but again, Clara is a commodity. And really, are you that much better than the other kids who were throwing their B3s around? You're still using them as, you know, toys, as things that benefit you. But again, like Marvin said, like it depends on whether or not you see Clara as a human being or not.
Yeah. I think it also depends on whether like what you wanted out of the story, right? Because I can see people who like were anticipating more of like a Bicentennial Man thing, right? Like a Robin Williams film where like all the servant robot gains sentience and becomes like recognized as a person. And it's like a triumphant like examination of like what makes a person a person. I don't think Clara ever truly becomes a person, right?
No. And you see that visually too. I say visually as if like, you know, because like you're reading a book, there are no pictures, but throughout the book there are moments where like she's unable to process like really high emotional states. So like her vision is like compartmentalized into like boxes, which is why like sometimes like you like in the book you're like, what, why is this person's eyeball like in this one box, and why is this person like merging with another body, it's just so weird. What is this kaleidoscopic surveillance camera that's happening right now? And it's because Clara is a machine. She like can't process everything at like the highest speed, so like things kind of get pixelated for her. It's almost like, you know, a JPEG in a way.
When you're watching YouTube and you're like, you lose bandwidth, and so
it goes like from 1040p, right? To like 480. Yeah, that's kind of what I pictured. You are reminded like pretty frequently that like, yeah, she seems to be human and she does have like these human traits, but she is a robot.
It's an interesting contrast between like reading it from Clara's point of view and reading like Never Let Me Go, where Never Let Me Go, they are by all accounts humans. They're clones, but they are humans with human, like with a sense of self and a sense of, you know, identity and emancipation, even though they're not free. Where Clara is like, no, she is a robot. She is following her, you know, she has agency to like kind of go off on side quests, but in the end, she is still like serving her one purpose. And like, it's such an interesting like thought experiment too, to like, we so badly want to give personhood to Clara, but in the end, like she is kind of like, we have to accept that she is serving on her purpose and like, okay with it, because she doesn't like, not that she doesn't know any better, but it's what she is made to do. Like she is made to take a child into adulthood and then that's it. And it kind of like, for me, I was like, can't they just like resell her? Like, can't they not just like not like
to like a lower income house? Yeah
like you know not to like, this is where we're like, you know, we told a very dangerous line between like human trafficking and like reselling, right? Like, but like, like, this is where, like, we get very close to, like, the human trafficking conversation, because, like, is, if Clara is a person, then, you know, you shouldn't traffic her like that. But, you know, I do put up baby gear that I'm not using on the Facebook marketplace to, like, sell to other people who might want it. And there is, like, I feel like Clara still has use, right? Still has so much to give because of her ability. So it was a little sad to see, like, oh yeah, like, her lot in life is to be left alone in the scrapyard. And, you know, it kind of sounds like they were built to become obsolete after a few years anyways, right? Kind of like an iPhone.
Yeah. Well, the fact that, like, you know, these kids, you know, get them when they're teenagers, because a new model comes out every, like, 3 years, maybe. Like, can you imagine if you're, like, a little kid and, you know, you get an artificial friend and you just throw it away when the next new version comes? It's it's really sad. I can see why, like, Kazuya Shiguro was like, let's make the kids teenagers. Let's not make them, like, 5-year-olds, because then it's a little weird. Like, what? Where did all their old artificial friends go?
Well, the AFs are also meant to be peers, right? Like, if you give a artificial friend to a child, like a 5-year-old, then it's more of a older sister or, like, nanny situation, right?
Yeah. But we've been yapping for a while.
I mean, it is a Kazuo Ishiguro book. Again, a book that will probably stick with me. The questions that Ishiguro poses through his prose is just they're profound, and they really, like, especially in this state of my life where I am a new parent, thinking about how to, like, raise my kids to make sure they're, like, good people and, like, ready to take on the world. Like, there's a lot of, like, I don't know how to answer some of the questions that he poses, because they're hard.
Yeah, they are quite hard. I am excited to see the movie. Let me see when the exact day is, because I do want to watch the movie and then talk with you on the show again, Marvin, about the movies, because it's very rare that you and I both, like, have read the book before the movie comes out. Yes, it comes out on October 23rd.
Yeah, I'm also excited about it. I you know, we talked about this a little bit on Discord, and, you know, there's a lot of discourse about whether or not Taika Waititi was the right director to take this on. I kind of feel like, because the story takes place from Clara's point of view, that, like, Taika's whimsy will work, like, works for me at least, because, like, inherently Clara is a very silly character, right? She believes silly things. She is very innocent and very, like, childlike, and I think that lends very well to, like, the vibes of a Taika Waititi film.
Yeah, and also just seeing, like, Jenna Ortega in the role of Clara is just so funny to me, because, you know, she's Wednesday from, like, Wednesday Addams. Like, I'm so used to her seeing, like, being, like, this goth kid, and now she's gonna be this sunshine robot. And it is a role that I think will give her a chance to flex her acting muscles, so that'll be pretty cool. Also, Amy Adams cast as Josie's mom is pretty great. I think that is great casting.
I do love the casting of Natasha Lyonne as the store manager. I feel like that is that's pretty good casting. Yeah,
well, we'll see. It would be great to, you know, talk about it on the show again. So we will table it for later. Although, like, it's coming out in theaters, Marvin. You need to get a babysitter so that you can, like,
I'll figure it out. See it. If anything, I'll wait for it to go on VOD, and then I'll watch it as soon as possible. But we'll figure it out. I guess with that, that'll do it for our discussion of Claire and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. If you have any thoughts about our discussion or on the book itself that you want to share with us, please let us know on our Discord or our Goodreads forums. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback on our discussion whenever possible. And I guess before we go, Rira, what book are we reading for book club in September?
September is my pick, and we are reading Fishbone Cinderella by Elizabeth Lim. We have heard Elizabeth Lim's name in a lot of, like, news episodes, because she's written a lot of books. Like, she's written Spin the Dawn, Unravel the Dusk, Six Crimson Cranes, she wrote A Forgery of Fates. She has fantastic covers. Every single book has like a banger cover, and Fishbone Cinderella also has a beautiful cover. But it is a multi-generational magical realism tale about a mother and daughter who must break their family's curse through trials of war and immigration. So the book has two settings. So we have 1940s Hong Kong, when the Japanese soldiers invade their hometown, and then you have the 1960s San Francisco. So I'm excited to finally pick up an Elizabeth Lim book for book club. And also, you know, we've been reading a little more magical realism historical fiction lately. So it would be nice to just kind of continue on that, like to roll on with it and see, like, and like compare and contrast with other works that we've read of that subgenre. So yeah.
Also, I feel like we're long overdue for an Elizabeth Lim book. I feel like that's been a name on our TBR for way too long. So I'm glad to finally dig into one of her books. If you are a Patreon supporter, don't forget to check our Discord for the reading schedule for our online discussion. As always, let's include your feedback on our discussion episodes whenever possible. And yeah, I guess that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu, and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba, and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former beer league player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Host the podcast Asians in Baseball alongside Naomi Koh and Scott Okamoto. Asians in Baseball is exactly what it sounds like, a podcast about the Asian and Asian Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Americans in Major League Baseball. Every week, we break down the highlights of what's going on with Asians in baseball and then take a deeper dive into the Asian and Asian Americans past and present who have shaped baseball as it is today. Whether you're Kim Eng's number one fan or you've never even heard of Hideo Nomo, we've got something for everyone, especially for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Maybe too much for the Shohei Ohtani stans. Listen to Asians in Baseball wherever you get podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.